Good morning, everybody. Stephanie, would you call roll, please?
William Gingold.
Here.
David Happ. I'm sorry. I grabbed the wrong sheet. Gail Kennedy. Deb Rouge.
Here.
Ann Robin.
Here.
Sue Suter.
Here.
I'd like to make a motion to approve the agenda as presented. Discussion, any questions, changes? Okay, I guess there is one thing that we would like to do. Since Dr. Robin has to leave a little bit earlier today, then we probably won't get through the whole meeting with her present. So what we'd like to do then is move item 10 under old business 10A mini grant process, which is a, you know, an actions requested for that particular item, up in the agenda to just under 8 financial information. So that would be the first item then under new business. Well, it's really old business, but right before we tackle new business, and then we'll go back to the rest of the format. Does anybody have any questions or concerns about that? Stephanie, do we need to restate the motion then to change that item? Okay, all agreed?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Item 4, citizen input, public participation.
I have something. Hi, Laura Bennett from DSC, and I just wanted to make everybody aware of a few events that are occurring now and some upcoming events. But first, I wanted to just say thank you for the board's continued support of the arts. And as a direct result of that, we have several artists from our Philo Road Community Day Services who are exhibiting their work and selling their work at international galleries in Lincoln Square Mall. So that is through October 29th. And here's a little bitty example of some of the work. So I wanted to tell you about that. Another thing is that we have an individual also exhibiting at Lincoln Square Mall, her artwork. Her name is Jackie, and she's had a personal outcome to have an art show, and it is happening at Common Ground Food Co-op. And so go out there and see her work. It's also in collaboration with some area poets. And that will be on display currently and into November. And then on November 15th, from 5 to 7, there will be a reception at Common Ground, and she will be there and displaying her art, and then other poets will be exhibiting or, you know, showcasing their work. And then finally, the Crow at 110 will be having a holiday open house on November 9th. From 3 to 5, and that's a Saturday afternoon. And it will be an open mic kind of format with music, poetry reading, and some artistic displays. So please come out and join us. And there are some handouts there for the Crow at 110 open house. So thank you.
Thank you, Laura. That's great. Okay, we have a heavy-duty agenda today. We have lots of presentations, so I'm not going to say anything except excited to hear all of this respite information today. Lynn, do you have comments?
I think I also defer.
Okay, item 7, the DDB board meeting minutes from the September 18th meeting are included, pages 4 to 7. Is there a motion? Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, is there a discussion? Okay. All right. I just have to look at one thing here. Okay, all in favor of approving them as presented?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, those minutes are approved. Financial information is presented on pages 8 and 9. I'd like to make a motion to approve them as presented. Okay, regarding discussion, I just have one comment about the United Cerebral Palsy $5,000 payout this past month. That disbursement happened just prior to the reorganization and or merger of Lincolnland UCP with Spark. And so it's my understanding that there will be a payback at some point to be determined exactly when and how much, correct?
It'll be more than $5,000 that they owe back. That's all in the contract, and we're working on that right now. I think Kim's been just yesterday figuring it out. Right?
Yeah, they were on a fee-for-service contract, so at the end of the month, I will run the final numbers to know exactly how much we should expect in a return.
Okay, so there's a motion on the table to present the financial information as presented. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that is financial information presented, the claims report. Okay. Jumping ahead to our agreed upon old business item, the mini grant process, that's item 10A, though that information is presented on pages 58 to 60. I'd just like to make a motion to, I'll just read it. Make a motion to approve the executive director and the CCDDB staff to implement a mini grant application review process as described in the memorandum. Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion. Just one comment. There's just a little tiny typo.
It's
kind of an important typo. Under paragraph or section 2, the discussion about preparing the application for review, the paragraph that starts Kim Bowdry, Associate Director, this information stipulates who's eligible for this mini-grant application process. And I'd just like to have an is inserted in the sentence that begins, if the applicant is not a Champaign County resident, not enrolled in PUNS, or there should be an is receiving long-term services through the state or county, the application will be marked as ineligible and the reason noted. And it's a little picky, maybe appears to be a picky little thing, but either an is or an is not changes completely the meaning of that particular line.
I put that in when I read it.
Did you see it too? Yeah.
I have a question. Since we haven't had experience with this at this point in time, I assume this will be subject to change based on experience.
I'll really try to keep it short in the interest of all this wonderful business we're about to do. I think because we've never done this before, it's really important for me to bring every step of it to you all for approval, and also, you know, we've already started thinking about what are we going to do if there are not very many applications, but we're committed to doing this, so we would make some changes and try it again, and that might be one of the things to change. And, you know, we've got some other feedback from you all. We're looking for feedback also from providers who are connected to people, and then eventually from the people who maybe wanted to fill out an application but for some reason weren't able to. So that's one eventuality we're already preparing for. The thing we're not preparing for is, what if we get a ton of applications and they're all great and we just don't have enough money? I think that's a good problem for us to have, not a good problem for people who bothered to fill out that. So we'll bring something back to you, either direction. Thank you for asking.
I failed to find in here, I'm sure it was available, but I just didn't see it. What is the dollar amount of the the top dollar amount. Can you show me where that is in your?
It's probably not in here because you approved the general, the launch of the process. And then I tried to trim out some of that, but the maximum is $5,000.
That's what I remembered, but I just didn't see it in here. Don't we want to put that in here up to a maximum of
$5,000? You've already approved that.
We did approve
you
that.
You did.
Okay, thank you.
So again, the motion is to approve the executive director and CCDDB staff to implement mini grant application review process as described in this memorandum. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? This is approved. Okay, going back then, moving back to new business in the agenda, the first item is a decision memorandum on the CCMHB and CCDDB travel policy, and the Champaign County travel policy is included for reference as well. And maybe, Lynn, you could just present a couple of highlights to us regarding this and why we've undertaken this change.
Well, the county has taken up revising all of their personnel-related policies. We have a personnel policy that mirrors theirs in most respects that was approved about a year and a half ago. So the personnel policy is done for now. Then they are also taking a travel policy, drug-free workplace, and internet policy. So we have, because the Mental Health Board and DD Board have a separate authority over their staff, we're trying to present you with policies which conform as closely to county rule as possible. The only thing that county has approved so far of those three is travel. So we have prepared all three, depending on what they do. They had a whole lot of ideas for their travel policy and only changed one thing in the end. So the county's travel policy continues as it has been for 10 years with one change, and that's to increase the threshold for required receipts. But that's not a change we wanted to make. So we left the threshold at what it has been, and then we added some language that restricts us and puts the authority under the Mental Health Board and DD Board. So there, in a few ways, our travel is more restricted than county employees just because of the purposes of the work.
Okay, so there may be some more discussion about this or some questions for Lynn, but I should put a motion on the table, or somebody should. I will, I guess, just go ahead and do that. Make a motion to approve the attached draft CCMHB CCDDB travel regulations pending approval by the CCMHB, which is an important part of that they're meeting tonight. So is there a second? Further discussion or questions for Lynn? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved.
Will we have a test on that?
We have to compare page by page.
Okay.
You can pick out the difference.
Okay, now for our first presentation. We have a building evaluation capacity presentation by the University of Illinois Evaluation Capacity Team. They're going to provide a brief update on their previous work and the work they will do with the targeted CCDDB-funded programs. Welcome.
Oh, sure. Okay, so there's a couple of things I can do today. We're very pleased to have the opportunity to speak with all of you at the Developmental Disabilities Board, which we have not had the opportunity to do yet. And the way that we started that work with the Mental Health Board was that we actually began with a little bit of evaluation 101. And by that I mean some introduction to basic terminology around evaluation. So we can do that today if that's helpful. I think the benefit of doing it, if you're not already familiar with that, is that it gives us a shared language around what evaluation is and what it isn't and the particular approach that we take to it. And also what we mean by evaluation capacity building. So if I were to make a suggestion about where to start, I think that's the starting place, as opposed to jumping right into the details of what partnership would look like, although we can touch on that if we have time. But if you're already feeling like we're very comfortable with the concepts related to evaluation, and we know what you mean by capacity building, then I can jump forward too and just talk about our kind of proposed activities and what that looks like. Thoughts? Make this participatory? Start at the very beginning? So I see one motion for starting at the beginning. And anyone have a different view, or is that okay?
Recently, pardon me, and where the rest of us, to an extent, have had a little more of a grounding, a little basic understanding of what you all have been doing. So. Mm-hmm. But she's a newbie again.
Well, I'll go through it somewhat quickly, but we're happy to come back anytime and talk on any of these topics in more detail or work with you in any capacity. So we're just happy to have the opportunity to begin. So go ahead, Lynn.
So we also we meet every once in a while with Mark and Nicole and a couple of Mental Health Board members as a committee. So you could come and join us.
I was going to say, and I can have a private tutorial too.
Yeah.
So that's fine since we have a long agenda.
Okay, so I'm going to start with this brief intro. And I want to talk about a few terms that will come up again and again as you have your funded agencies presenting back to you. So evaluation, often when people think about evaluation, they think about outcome evaluation. They think about the basic question, does something work? But there are lots of other questions that one might ask, right? Like not just does something work, but under what conditions and for whom does something work? And for under what conditions does something work for particular groups? But this is typically called a summative outcome, right? So a summary judgment about something, does it work? But there's also formative work. And I think the formative work is very important because that's really when we're asking questions about process. How did we deliver this service? Who received it? Who tends to access it more than others? Those are all questions about how we do our work. And those will also fall under the umbrella of evaluation. And they can also be very key to improving our practice. So a summary is important to say, is this worthwhile? Is it worth our time and effort? But formative is really about tweaking our process so we're providing the best service possible. And the other terminology that I want to put out here is fidelity. And fidelity is whether or not we're doing something as we intended to do it. So does our implementation of a particular program match how that program was supposed to be implemented? And this is often particularly important with any kind of evidence-based practice, because often when something's already established, like this works, right? This works and it works for the population that we're serving. Sometimes it doesn't work in your local community, and it's because you've deviated too much from the studied model. And so fidelity is about how closely were we matching that model in the first place. So in some ways, we always say that people are always evaluating, right? How well did that recipe work? You know, analogous questions, what would make our services better? How closely was the recipe followed? Did we implement the evidence-based practices indicated? What did the people who cooked, ate, or paid for the meal think? So what did the people served by our agency experience, and what outcomes or changes resulted for those served? I like this food analogy. This is Robert Stake is a famous evaluator and famous kind of work on case study. And he says, when the cook tastes the soup, that's formative. When the guest tastes the soup, that's summative, right? And I think that kind of works, right? When we're looking at our own practice, that's that formative piece. But at the end of the day, it's the people who eat the soup that decide whether or not the soup is working for them. What I want to say here is that we really want to see evaluation always as tied to action. The idea in building a learning community around evaluation with the funded agencies of the Mental Health Board and the Developmental Disabilities Board is to create a learning community where people view evaluation as something that's built in, something that's useful because it helps us do the best possible work. And that's really a cultural shift because often evaluation feels like this. I don't know if you can see this. This is Santa Claus, and he's talking one to a deer, and the other deers are mounted on the wall, and they're labeled slow, lazy, and bad attitude. And often evaluation is experienced this way, especially when it's summative. In reality, it's often very difficult to make summative judgments about whether or not something works in the short term. And so we want to shift a feeling around evaluation like this and to something that's like, hey, don't we want to know what we do, how we do it, when it works, for whom? Because we're not in the business here of just doing this work just to do it, right? We want to have a positive impact on individuals' lives. So we don't want to create a culture around blaming or finger pointing. And we also really want to foster a learning environment rather than one of compliance. And this is, and we're not talking about any particular agency here in this community. These are broad reflections. But often when people are responding to funders, and I'm working on a large partnership right now elsewhere in the state, there's an emphasis on compliance. What does the funder want us to do? We need to do it because we want to continue to get these federal dollars. That is usually not a very generative space because that's about, I know what I need to do and I check the box. And we want to shift to a place that says, I want to be curious about what we're doing and why it works, right? And under what conditions and for whom and what happens to the people that we're serving. And that's a really important shift. One is based in curiosity, and the other is based often in fear of loss of funding, et cetera. So we want to move away from a compliance orientation. And you as funders are a huge part of that shift. Because if you want to cultivate that learning in your funded agencies, while yes, this is something that you are requiring, so there is a compliance element, we want to go beyond compliance merely. Okay, I'm just going to pause for a moment. Any questions or clarification? I said that would be brief. That's a little 101. Okay, so what about this capacity building? You know, capacity refers to the ability or power to do, experience, or understand something. And in organizations, capacity building refers to efforts to strengthen operations. And part of the approach that we took when we started this partnership many years ago now with the Mental Health Board was that we wanted to create something that would be sustainable for agencies. Getting external evaluation done on a regular basis is very expensive to do, right? If you are relying on external evaluators for every single funded program, that's something you could do periodically. We've talked about this a number of times. But we wanted to create capacity within the agency to engage in activity that would be sustainable for them. And this is an ongoing goal because this is really what the partnership is about. It's about setting a process in motion where we're looking very carefully at how the agency currently gathers data, how they currently utilize that, who they're serving, what they want to know, what their theory of change in their logic model is, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And then we want to build knowledge and skills. We want to build buy-in around evaluation. And then we want to build the resources. So what is it that that agency would need to sustain the practice over time? And ideally, we want to build support networks. So agencies have presented back to the Mental Health and Disability Developmental Disabilities Board funded agencies meeting. That is a really long acronym. I just want to say the CCMHD, right, you get what I'm saying. And I just love when that occurs because that's an opportunity to create a learning culture among the funding agencies where they're getting to hear about what their peers have done. And ideally, as we have a set of funded agencies with a skill set like this, in the ideal world, you'd see peer-to-peer support, the sharing of instruments, the sharing of processes, the sharing of ideas. So that's something to be working toward. So this is from the literature. Some of the strategies around evaluation capacity building, so coaching, training, having experienced consultants, providing tools and resources, encouraging peer learning, and working on technology. And these are all elements of what we're trying to do. The coaching and training comes through the partnership, also comes through the consultation bank. We are the experienced consultants working behind the scenes to support the work that agencies are doing. We've been developing a bank of tools and resources that some agencies have utilized, but everything that we create with a targeted partner goes in the bank. I mean, goes in the a Google Doc space where any agency can then go in and use those same measures. So the idea is that we're creating something not just for one agency, but that could live there for others. And this is a way more complicated model, and I'm not going to go through this, But I put it up because I think it actually captures a lot of the complexity. In introducing evaluation activity that you sustain in the context of an agency is a higher order change. It's a complex change. Evaluation is a complex act, and it's a big ask on top of all the direct service work that agencies do. And so I won't go through this, but I'm happy to share it because it goes through all of the different elements that one might need to be building in. And this is something that we use to guide our practice and to think about what we're trying to build in funded agencies. So we aim to have our evaluation capacity reflect local priorities and realities in terms of resources, in terms of time, staff, technology, the priorities of the agency in terms of what they want to know. And then we work together to figure out the best ways to structure evaluation to pursue the questions of interest and what systems need to be in place to collect, analyze data, present findings, and use those findings. And what we're finding with the mental health agencies that we've worked with for a few years now is that that latter piece around the analysis and use of the information is where the growing edge still is. And so we are redoubling our efforts with our previously targeted agencies to build their capacity around use, interpretation, and application. What does this mean now? We learned this. What does it mean for the way we adjust our practice? So I'll pause there for a moment. Any questions or comments? I hope it's because I'm super clear this early Wednesday morning. So, okay. So in terms of our proposed activities, and I recognize that this is small, I actually tried to put it on two slides yesterday, and I couldn't get the numbering to work, and I gave up. But from an accessibility standpoint, I shouldn't have. But this comes right from our proposal. So we want to continue to create a learning organization. We want to support the development of theory of change logic models. We have multiple logic model workshops set up, and we would have you encourage your agencies to attend if they haven't already. We are happy to share with you more about what a theory of change logic model is. But in essence, it is the agency's opportunity to articulate what it is they want to achieve and by what processes they think they're getting there. So what intermediate outcomes are really facilitating getting to those longer-term outcomes, and how do their activities link? Those of you who have been in a workshop with me know that I love logic models because I love taking the chaos of what's going on in our minds or in our activity or in our day-to-day and trying to get it out into a space that I can show you. This is the flow. This is what I think is what's happening. And what's really key to that is that if you don't have that articulated, you can't evaluate because you don't know what the what is, right? So the logic model is the first step with every targeted partner, but it's something that we offer to all funded agencies. We're doing quarterly follow-up with our previously targeted agencies, and that may even be more frequent for those who are willing to continue to work with us more intensively. The consultation bank. This is where any agency can just come and ask us a question, and some do. And it's okay if they don't even really know what their question is. Like they say, we're supposed to do this, but we have no idea how. We can engage in a targeted partnership in terms of time intensity, but often we can provide some short-term guidance and ideas. Sometimes, for example, we got a question recently about helping identify a measure that would help screening around multiple mental health issues, including psychosis. You just need help identifying a good screening tool. It's a targeted kind of question, but we're willing to entertain those. And if it's too big, we can say, okay, we've got to get you into a targeted partnership or try to work with them to get them to a point. Continuing to build the buffet of tools, as I mentioned, every tool we create with any single agency, we put in a space for all agencies to access. And then the last piece is meeting with all of you. You know, building capacity, evaluation capacity among agencies, building that among the funders is key too. And we have found that the more the contact that we've had with the mental health board, it helps to know what you're hoping for and what your questions are. And as you see shifts, hopefully over time occurring in reporting, what you want to see more of and what you're curious about. So your priorities are also important in that process. So those are our proposed activities, and I think with the time we have, I will leave it at that. And if you have any questions, we're also very happy to come back and share work in progress and tell you how that's going with the targeted partners from the DD board. We're going to be working with Community Choices and also DSC, and that work is already underway in terms of scheduling meetings to be getting together and really doing that work in earnest. Any questions or comments? Go ahead.
Could you share your PowerPoint with us so it can
certainly
be put on our website for the agencies?
Certainly. Happy to do that. Yes.
Thank you.
We'll put that as an addendum to the meeting agenda. Is that enough?
Sure.
That's okay for you? So if anybody wants to find it, that'll
Since I'm the newbie, how many mental health agencies have we worked with in partnership, the Mental Health Board?
To this point, we've done a targeted partnership with 11, although we've also, we've done consultation with more than the 11. So I don't have that number handy in my head right now, but
that
do you?
That gives me a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. We have the dates of the logic model meetings. I think Mark and Kim both have them, and if you want to forward them one more time, we still have some space in each one, and if we need to schedule another, we can do that as well. We're also thinking about scheduling sort of a technological support kind of workshop. We haven't talked about this with Mark or Kim yet, but around things like creating a really usable Excel file, for example. Because we encounter some of the same themes over and over again, even in terms of how people prepare their data or organize their data. And so we're going to come up with some special topics like that, again, around building capacity, around specific skills.
Nicole, did you say you have the dates for the logic model meetings?
I do have them if you want them
sure.
right now. So October 29th at 3 p.m. at Brookins. Oh, sorry. That's the library, the Champagne Library, in one of the rooms downstairs, the big rooms, like the Robeson, I think. I can't remember the name right now. And then Tuesday, November 12th at 3 p.m. Is that Brookins, Mark? There were two at Brookins and two at the library. Got it. So that one's at the library also. And then Monday, November 18th from 10 to 12 is here at Brookins. And we've sent that via email, but we can send it again.
Thank you. Thank you, Nicole and Mark.
Thank you all.
Thanks.
Okay. Next up, Katie Harmon from ISC, RPC.
Hello, my name is Katie Harmon. I'm the Community Services Program Manager at Champaign County Regional Planning Commission, and I oversee the Independent Service Coordination Program. Kim is passing around a handout that I prepared. I was asked at the last meeting to do a really kind of brief overview of the PUNS process and what that looks like and what it means and eligibility. So I wanted to give the handout to everybody so you have this as a takeaway. It's, again, it's a summary. I've also linked in the actual presentation the websites that have the State Department of Human Services regulations and more in detail about eligibility. So in your free time, if you want to take a look more in detail at those, please feel free to do so. So that's why I included those. Just kind of as a quick recap, and many of you know this, so I apologize if I'm giving information that you already know. PUN stands for Prioritization for Urgency of Need for Services, so it couldn't be a more complicated acronym and title of what that means. I know we work with families all the time who are like, what is that? I mean, it's just, you don't know what it means from the title. It's confusing. So I always try and give them more detail, of course, about what that is. Essentially, it is a state waiting list for people who have intellectual and developmental disabilities who are interested in getting services through the Medicaid home and community-based services waiver. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So this was created, I believe, outside of the state of Illinois, and the state of Illinois adopted this process. Initially, it wasn't even meant to be used as a waiting list, is my understanding, but essentially that's what it is now. And I have some numbers as far as people in Champaign County on puns and then people in the state. I mean, the numbers are so large, it's sad, actually. But puns enrollment, let me just touch on that quickly. So our agency serves as the organization that registers people on the puns database. So we do try and do a lot of outreach events with schools and organizations in the community and providers about our organization and puns, so we can make sure people are getting registered on the puns database. Our first meeting, they would contact Regional Planning Commission, ask about puns, and they're going to meet with one of our independent service coordinators. Her name's Mary Rasher. So she handles all puns enrollments for Champaign County. I directly supervise Mary. She's located office-based here at Brookins in our regional planning offices. And then from there, people need to meet with Mary annually to update their information. So the first meeting, when someone's getting enrolled, that has to be a face-to-face meeting. If there are no significant changes, we can do the update via phone. So that's fine, too. If some people prefer to come in person and meet with Mary, that's totally fine. We can absolutely accommodate that, but it's really based on the preference. If there are significant changes or someone believes that their situation might be a crisis, which I'll touch on later too, we encourage them to come in person to meet with us so we can kind of gauge more about what's going on. So eligibility on page two here. All of this is directly through the Department of Human Services Division of Developmental Disabilities criteria. So this isn't Regional Planning's criteria. We didn't set this criteria. This is kind of what we're going by, dictated by the state. So 2.5+ years. The PUNS database isn't meant for early intervention services, so children 0 to 3 really aren't appropriate, but they can get registered on PUNS starting at 2.5 years old. There needs to be a presence of an intellectual disability. It kind of details that below. And I just want to note, I was chatting with Heather about this. I always provide families, if they're interested, in the exact information on DHS's website. If some people really want to see it for themselves, I will send them all of the information. I encourage Mary to do so. But I always give the caveat is the language used through the Department of Human Services Division of Developmental Disabilities is really outdated. They still reference mental retardation, which is unfortunate, so they haven't quite caught up with the appropriate language to use. So I always change it on our end to use the appropriate language, but I like to just kind of give people a heads up, because if you're reading that, you're like, what? People are still using this language? It's just wanted to throw that out there. So as far as eligibility, continued on page 3. Related conditions, so listed here, attributable to cerebral palsy or epilepsy. Any condition other than mental illness found to be closely related to a developmental disability, manifested before age 22, and then there has to be substantial functional limitations in 3 or 4 of the following areas, and this is small print, I'm sorry, but related to self-care, language, learning, mobility, self-direction, and capacity for independent living. And in our manual, the state's manual, dictating eligibility, it goes into more detail with all of those different areas. So if you really want to drill down and see what we're looking for, it's listed in the manual that I cited on the previous slide. I think the biggest thing is that, and challenges that we run into, is that we have to have some sort of documentation for intellectual disability prior to age 18, or a related condition prior to age 22. And so when we're meeting with families and clients early on, especially if they're under 18, I really encourage people to save all of your documentation. Save the documentation from your IEP meeting at the school. Save any health-related medical documentation, any psychological evaluations. Save that documentation, because we have to have that when we're submitting the information to the state of Illinois to get that person funding for services. And that can be really challenging, because sometimes we're meeting with people who are 40, 50 years old. They maybe were cared for by family members. They weren't familiar with PUNS, and they have absolutely no documentation, so we really try and work with them to get that in place so they're able to get the funding that they need. We've worked with families or clients, excuse me, who were homeless before, and they don't have, let alone having documentation from before 18. I mean, they don't have a state ID. They don't have a Social Security card. They don't have their IEP from 30 years ago. So that's really challenging. So we really try and advocate and work with them to get the paperwork that we need. Let's see. I'm going to jump ahead here to page 4. And I mentioned this age of onset. The age of onset of the individual's intellectual disability or a related condition must be documented in the psychological assessment for an intellectual disability or the physician's assessment for related conditions. There are also, if someone is selected from the PUNS database for funding, there's certain time frames as to how old that paperwork can be. And so one of the things that we'll do, if someone has a psychological evaluation and they're selected from PUNS and it's 10 years old, we have contracts with licensed clinical psychologists in the area that we can help them get that assessment in place so they can have it for getting, making sure they're getting their funding. As far as categories, PUNS underwent some pretty significant changes in the last year. There used to be 3 categories, and now there's 2. So there's a seeking services category and there's a planning category. So seeking services is anyone who currently needs or desires supports. Planning is they don't currently need or want supports, but they might in the future. This is a very important distinction. Because when the state of Illinois is selecting people from the PUNS database, they are only selecting people from the seeking services category. So if someone is in the planning category on PUNS, they will never be selected. So it's we try and do our best to educate families about what that means, especially with the changes. So planning category, you know, if we're looking like 10, 15, 20 years down the line or some really far out date, then maybe planning would be appropriate. But really, most people who need or want services should be in the seeking services category. And I also referenced the state recently updated the PUNS manual. And so I referenced that, which goes into a little bit more detail. So please feel free to look at that as well. There are certain situations in which a person can bypass the PUNS waiting list, and those criteria is related to a crisis situation. And the crisis situation is really narrowly defined by the Department of Human Services. So they have to be at risk of or currently experiencing abuse, neglect, or homelessness. Those 3 specific situations. It is very difficult to get somebody funding through crisis, but we do our best to get as much documentation as possible, and we're kind of serving as the advocate and helping somebody get that funding. You know, it's difficult because I believe that many families are in crisis, and they define their situation as crisis, but unfortunately, we have to go by this really kind of narrow criteria is what the state of Illinois is defining a crisis as. And we always let families know, too, you know, we're going to be asking a lot of specific questions, and it can seem really invasive, but we're trying to gather as much documentation as possible to present a case as clear-cut and detailed that we hope will result in them getting funding and services that they need. It also, when I say abuse, that can also be related to maybe somebody has some severe behavioral issues and maybe they're aggressive to other siblings in the household or parents, and parents are feeling like, you know, we've tried. This isn't a safe environment anymore for everybody involved. That could fit under that criteria. So I just wanted to throw that out there as well. Ultimately, DHS, the Division of Developmental Disabilities, has the final decision. So what we do as the Independent Service Coordination Agency, we gather all of this required documentation, we submit it to the division, and then they make the determination if they're approving it or not. There is an appeal process in place, so we've had people who were denied based on clinical eligibility. The state is saying, nope, they're not clinically eligible, or they don't meet the crisis criteria. We can appeal. So we'll say, hey, we still have an appeal chance or right with our clients, and we can submit an appeal. We've been successful in getting people funding through an appeal. It just takes a really long time. It can take months, which is unfortunate, but still, you know, we tell people to hang in there, and at least we have another recourse to try and advocate and argue the situation. So selection from PUNS, again, this is a recent change over the last year. It's based on length of time on the waiting list in the seeking services category, starting at essentially the time-sensitive waiting clock starts at 18, at 18 and older. So a lot of people ask, well, what's the point of getting on PUNS if, you know, my child is 10 years old, if essentially they're not going to be selected based on time on the waiting list until after 18? And it's a totally legitimate question. I thought the same thing myself when the kind of regulations were changed. I think it's important in many ways. If the person were ever to, you know, reach that level of possibly meeting crisis criteria, we're already familiar with them. They have our contact information. We have their contact information, and they're on the waiting list. Secondly, I think it's really important for the Division of Developmental Disabilities at the state to know how many people are in need of services and how many children we have from ages, you know, 2.5 years old to, 18, are going to be in need of services when they turn 18 in adult developmental disability services. And secondly, I mean, we've seen lots of changes across the state. There's been various lawsuits. There's been a lot of things that have happened. And so maybe, and I have no idea, that in case there were ever to be children's selection from the PUNS database, I would want families already to be registered and on that database. So again, and we give all of this information and try and be as clear cut as possible. Yeah, Kim.
This is also our eligibility criteria.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's also important.
Yes.
And
thank you.
Right now we're bound by statute to do.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. And for funded programs through the DDB, including our services that we offer through this, the funding here, people need to be registered on PUNS. Yes. Thank you. I missed that. And sorry, I called you Kim, but I meant Lynn. Okay. The services through PUNS, again, this would take up a whole presentation, but the services through home and community-based services, through the Medicaid waiver, there's home-based support, SILA funding, and again, there's a really comprehensive, detailed description of all of those different services which we go over with people registering on PUNS on what they might be eligible for. It's really important that people have an understanding of what services they can get through the funding, because we wouldn't want to be in a situation where someone is selected from the PUNS list and then decides, oh, well, I don't really want any of those services. Reason being, if someone declines the services, another name from our county is not selected. So essentially that's losing funding for somebody that we could have had in our community. So we really try and make that clear cut. Here's what's available. Are those services you think you might want or need? And then register them accordingly. So it is really important that people have an understanding of services available. And then PUNS data, skipping to page 7, I pulled this, on the 8th of this month. There were 446 active PUNS in Champaign County, and then about 19,500 active PUNS in the state of Illinois. Yes.
Yeah. Of those 446 active PUNS people on the list,
yes.
How many are seeking and how many are planning?
I can find that data and I will send it to Kim or Lynn to send out to the board.
Okay.
But yes, I can get those numbers for you.
And then regarding seeking versus planning, at the yearly update, is there the opportunity for individuals to move from one to the other?
Absolutely, and at any time.
So
you don't have to wait until your update. So if someone said, hey, you know, I'm current, or maybe they don't know. So they can call us and say, what category am I in? Okay, it looks like based on our last discussion, you were in planning. Is that still the case? Do you need services, want services now or in the near future? We can change that at any time. And then just as far as PUNS contact, I left Mary's direct information. This has her direct line. This has her email address. So please feel free to contact her directly. She's happy to answer any questions. And then on the last page, I also included my information. I can say that I feel good about the funding that we've received here through the Developmental Disabilities Board and the work that we're doing with our transition consultants. I feel like we've developed some really good connections with the schools in Champaign County to do more education about PUNS so people have an understanding from early on. And so I'm really appreciative to our schools in Champaign County who have been really receptive to us coming in. We've done in-service presentations with special education teachers and social workers. And especially with PUNS changes over the last year, they've been receptive to us coming back in and providing education on, you know, what PUNS is, what it means, why it's important. So that's been extremely helpful. But that's just a really brief overview. If I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody has about PUNS.
Anybody questions for Katie?
I hope this was helpful. Yeah.
I have some else I'll mention later, but
sure.
When you were talking about the telling people to hold their documentation,
yes,
from those pre-18 years, it's also important if you ever want to leave the state of Illinois,
yes,
because states all have a different eligibility process.
Yes.
And, you know, we have had the experience where a person hasn't kept their documentation because things were made quite easy for them locally, and then moved to another state which has a rigorous eligibility process, and then died because they couldn't get services. So it's really important that people understand, and, you know, if they're homeless, maybe someone can help them by holding on to those documents for them.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really good point. And kind of on the flip side, too, if we have people moving to our community from a different state, and in some states the criteria was way less rigorous, and they were able to get services, you know, right after graduation from high school, and then they come here, and I'm going through the kind of near mirror, going through the detail and the criteria, and it can be really daunting, but I encourage the same thing, any sort of supporting documentation, please keep that.
Question.
Yes.
Does the Regional Planning Commission have any incidence or prevalence data in terms of IDD?
Can you clarify? I'm sorry, I'm not sure what the question
is. In other words, if you take Champaign County and you look at the population, how do we determine to what extent in that population we have the prevalence or incidence of IDD individuals?
Thank you.
Okay, moving on, we have Shaughnessy Schroeder here from the Central Illinois Respite. From Envision Unlimited, your title is you're the Central Illinois Respite Director, correct, Shaughnessy? Okay, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm just here to talk about our in-home respite program. I see a couple of familiar faces because I'm pretty much in Champaign once a week, just about. I think last week was the only week in the last 3 months that I have not traveled at all, so I'm constantly moving throughout the state of Illinois. The reason for that is because this in-home respite program is actually for 18 counties here in Illinois, and so just to give you a little bit of background about Envision, Envision has been providing in-home respite for roughly 30 years in Cook County in Chicago, and so the state of Illinois recognized that we're doing that, and we're doing it pretty well, and we've executed that and added in a lot of families and helped provide relief. And so with that, we were given a grant to pretty much help families who are on this waiting list that she, you know, just kind of touched on. So it's really provided a lot of relief to families that are in that dire need. The only eligibility requirements are that, one, the individual must have a developmental disability, and two, they must not currently be receiving services at this time. Like she said, I am the Central Illinois Respite Director, and I do manage all of these different counties except for Cook County. We have a director just for that area because Cook County is its own ballpark. I worked in Missouri for roughly 8 years providing assistance to an agency there, and so moving from Missouri to Illinois, back to Illinois, which is, you know, my heart and passion because this is where I was born and raised, I have seen that there's a huge difference between states and how quickly that people are able to receive services. And so it's been a great push of mine to be able to help as many families as possible. With this service, families essentially can receive 180 hours of in-home respite services to assist them for their child or for the person that's in their care. We assist individuals as young as 2 years old and up to as old as you can think of. There is no age limit, to the adult age, and then we just stop at two. And so this is really for all families, but we do give prioritization to the families that are on the PUNS list, just because we recognize that they've kind of made the legwork already to get those services, and they are most likely in a higher need than families who maybe haven't gotten on the PUNS list yet. So we do prioritize them first to getting the service, but there is no waiting list. And I always tell any group that I speak with, any board, any family or ISC, that there is not a waiting list for these services. We have been able to match families with respite workers or assist them in getting their respite workers ready to provide the service if they have identified their own respite worker. So it's really been a really great collaboration with all of these different counties. We, like I said, we do provide respite workers if families are unable to identify their own. Currently, we have roughly 8 families that have not been matched with a respite worker, and so that's through all 18 counties that we have only 8 families that haven't matched with a respite worker. We find that connecting with universities has helped us greatly. We have connected with universities throughout the state, but here in Champaign, Parkland Community College has been a great resource for us. I spoke with Lynn, I think just 2 weeks ago, and we hadn't made a connection in Champaign, and here we are. You know, Parkland's already giving us referrals just for staff members and providing respite. But throughout the state, it's been great for us just because a lot of our respite workers are students who are in special education, who are in speech pathology, who are wanting to go into that field, and they really like being able to learn what they learn in the classroom and use that in a real-life experience. We pay the staff members at the minimum wage of $8.25 per hour. That was something that was, or I think it's $8.25 or $8.53, roughly in there. But that was something that was identified by the state of Illinois just to help as many families as possible. Because there is no cap for how many families can receive this service, They identified that receiving $8.25 per hour would be able to help the maximum amount of families in all these 18 counties. And when the minimum wage goes up in January and then again in July, they'll also receive that increase, which I think is $9 in January and then I want to say $9.50 or $10 in July. So families who already have a respite worker that they can think of, where that might be a neighbor, it might be a friend, it might be a brother or a sister, we assist them to receive any training that they need. One being that they take an online course to talk about Illinois Rule 50 and how they just must take care of the individual that's in their care, abuse and neglect, and how they have to treat them with respect and so forth. And then after that, they take CPR first aid. And then once that's completed, we process them into our onboarding for payroll. They get paid every 2 weeks, just like any employee would at any agency. It's been a very seamless transition with families who already have their own respite workers, but also with matching families, it's been really great to see those students who are really excited to help families be able to use what they learn in the classroom. We've also been able to collaborate with PACE, and they've been very helpful in providing staff in the Champaign County as well. So I think I've kind of touched on pretty much everything. I almost always forget something whenever I meet with these different groups. So you guys can ask as many questions as you like as I continue. Do you have any questions so far?
Shauna, see, there was some discussion about what's required of parents or families when this worker would come into their home. Are families allowed to then leave the home, or do they have to be there with the service provider?
Sure. So families are able to leave the home. We do have a maximum hours per day that a respite worker can work in the home, which is 10 hours. We don't provide respite workers to provide service overnight just because the liability there is a little bit greater and it is an in-home service only. So it's not a service that's in the community or employment. But yes, they're able to leave the home, go out of town, anything that they're comfortable doing. When families do not identify their own respite worker, we do have a lot of training just with that staff member and the family so that they can really get comfortable with one another. Because otherwise, if they're not comfortable, then that could, you know, lead to difficulties in the home. But they get a lot of training just so that they can feel comfortable for when that family leaves and they don't feel that they aren't capable to take care of the person that's in their care. Any other questions so far? So, like I said, I kind of talked about just the families that we have been providing the service to. Champaign County has actually been, you guys are really great with just communicating with families and communicating with one another. I've heard conversation through special education teachers that they've heard about our information through different groups here in Champaign. You guys are all very connected, so I commend you guys on that just because meeting with other areas. They're not quite as connected as Champaign, and maybe that's why I'm here once a week. So you guys do a great job, and I want to just commend you guys on that because really the families feel like they're very supported, and they feel like they have the assistance that they need when they need it, at least from my experience. You know, I have very little experience, but with that experience in Champaign, it's been very good. So I don't have anything else, but if you guys have any questions, you guys can email respiteinfo@envisionunlimited.org, and that's spelled respiteinfo at envisionunlimited.org, and that's envisionunlimited. And that goes to our email portal that pretty much captures all families that have an interest in receiving respite or getting a worker or getting connected. I did mention that families can receive 180 hours of in-home respite. That's per fiscal year. And so, you know, families that are starting to receive this service now, they actually are kind of having a lot of extra hours because it's not per month and it's not per week. It's per fiscal year. So anyone who starts in October has all of those banked hours from July, August, and September and so forth. But also if a family utilizes all of their hours, all 180, they can request another additional 120. So a total of 300 hours can be utilized. And if each family has two children with a developmental disability, they can have 300 hours maximum each. So I always let families know that because a lot of families have used respite in the past, but it might not have been as robust as the hours that they're receiving through this program. So, yeah, they can just contact me through there. And if you guys have any questions, you're more than welcome to as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Shansi, do you know how many families in Champaign you've been able to help so far?
That is a great question. We do quarterly reports, and our first one is coming up, I think, next month. And so we do track data just to be able to, you know, have that information, but we haven't gotten to that point yet.
Okay. Okay.
And helping all these different counties, we do, we're at about, I want to say, 100 families total, and that's not including Cook County. And I will say, I did mention the grant that was received. We have received a separate grant for the 17 counties, and then Cook County has its own grant, and so they have their own separate amount of money, and this multi-funded grant is, you know, has been obviously for 30 years in Chicago, but I get a lot of questions about that because some people wonder if, you know, is Cook County going to take all of our funds that we have, but they have their own separate pool because they're their own separate beast. So.
Well, and we really appreciate it. I know our agency just in the last month has referred 35 to 40 people to you guys.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Are you collar counties and then straight down south of Cook County, or do you go west too?
So we go as far down as Quincy, but really, even though we have 18 counties, Peoria, Sangamon, Livingston, Tazewell, McLean, the state connections that we have through the Department of Human Services, if we find a family that really is in need and they're not in one of our identified counties, then we reach out to them, and typically they are able to provide whether we can give the service or not. They have never told us that we can't take on someone in a different county. So we actually have two families, one in Ford County and one in Christian County, who are not on our 18 counties that we provide services to, and we now provide services to them. And so really, as we continue to grow, we'll, I'm sure, surpass 18 counties because we already have. So even though, you know, we have these few counties, I am sure that we'll continue to grow.
Shaughnessy, where do you get most of your referrals? From agencies or special ed?
Yeah, so that's a great question. A lot of our referrals come from either special education teachers, and sometimes they come from different ISCs. A lot of the time they come from different ISCs, so families who are already on the PUNS list, or from families who haven't quite gotten to the PUNS list. They've talked to maybe their special education teacher and said that they need assistance. And they've reached out to us and kind of facilitated that. That's mostly where we get our referrals, but sometimes it's from agencies who maybe only provide day services, and the family needs more assistance and things like that. Okay, well, thank you, guys.
Thank you. Okay. Illinois Respite Coalition. Tina Urich, director, is here to provide an overview of their respite service programs. Sure.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to take up the whole camera. I'm like, maybe I should go over there. So, hi, my name is Tina Urich, and I'm the director of the Illinois Respite Coalition, and thank you for being here, and I think it's great that we are just following Envision and their respite program. So I wrote out exactly what I was going to say in the beginning, but I'm going to mix it up. So I think what's important for you to know is what are the services that we offer that's the same as Envision. We both received a grant from the Department of Human Services to provide in-home respite. The Illinois Respite Coalition serves 16 counties. We are able to serve up to 200 families. The eligibility is the same. The family has to have a loved one with a diagnosed developmental disability. We also provide 180 hours for the fiscal year, which began July 1st through June 30th. We will assist in helping the families find a respite worker. We've done some of the same, you know, recruiting with the colleges. I will also say, from doing a lot of different outreach, it's amazing how many professionals will come up and say, I want to give back to my community. So that's one other piece, too, that you have is a lot of the different schools and their personnel coming up saying, you know what, I would love to do this. For the training, we also offer an online training. The workers also have to take CPR and first aid and complete all the background checks. The workers have to be 18 years and older and cannot be a family member living in their home. So it could be a family member outside of their home, but it could not be somebody living in their home. It's about providing respite to the family. There is no cost, and some families still ask me that question, and I'm like, no, this is a grant from DHS that allows us to provide these services. So we will work with families, and then it's even in our literature, if you don't have anybody, then it's our responsibility to help find somebody for you. We have a process with the families, and it's really give us a call. We'll do an intake, explain our program and our services, and send you an application and get this started, and then do the same with talking to them about workers. This is a first-time in-home grant for the Illinois Respite Coalition. We were excited to get this. We've had funding from DHS in the past and the federal government and different foundations, but it was more to support our emergency respite care grant. And that is a grant that provides support across the lifespan. So what that means is from birth through adulthood, with any disability or condition that needs ongoing care. So you'll see information in our brochure about that ERC program, and that's where we've had the majority of our experience. When this grant became available, it was something that the state came to us and said, you have that statewide reach. You know, did you want to try for this in-home? So we are new in this first quarter. It's been going to all 16 counties and attending as many parent groups as we can, school open houses, meeting with special ed directors and so on, going to LIC meetings where I was fortunate enough to meet you, Kim, who invited me to come today. So thank you. And I think it's important to have both of us. So I'm hoping for referrals. I'm hoping to get families from Champaign County. And I'm happy that we have two here, information from the PUNS. We have 400 people on that list. I'm happy to come work together, get a family night, and I'll even bring staff to sign families up. We will do whatever it takes to serve families. We have a working board. We have money, and we want to help families. And that's where we are. I'm not serving anybody. Right now, I have 25 families who have applications in. I can serve 200. So my role has been just going out, telling you who we are and what we do. A little bit about the Illinois Respite Coalition is it was formed in 1998 by a group of concerned parents and respite providers who was nervous at the time about respite and wanting to improve services for caregivers. So what we do outside of this in-home funded respite program. We're waiting to hear funding for our emergency respite care, which provides a stipend to families who have loved ones with dementia, Alzheimer's, cancer. We provide daily support to anybody who calls us. So they will get that individualized information and referral across the state. And then what we also do is provide respite training to whether it's parent groups or professionals who will invite us at lunchtime to come and talk about respite. So that's everything in a nutshell, trying to piggyback on Envision and their wonderful services too that they provide.
Just also for your in-home, is it age 2 through the lifespan, just like Envision's is?
Yeah,
or?
So I'm going to say, we say birth, but they really have to be receiving services then from early intervention.
Okay.
So as long as they have that IFSP. So it can be a little bit, earlier for a visible disability.
Is it an either-or situation, either Envision or your agency?
Yeah,
or?
You know what? I mean, you guys have a tough choice.
Mm-hmm.
We're both good agencies.
Okay.
But you cannot,
Can't
you know,
double
you
dip, huh?
I know. You can't, So it would just be one provider,
Okay.
Yeah. And you could not be receiving any other kind of services as well with Envision. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you're welcome.
Any other questions for Tina?
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Please. Is the wage, what is the wage for the workers?
So our wage is $12.50. And and we just looked at trying to help and get good support for families. So that's a decision that the Illinois Respite Coalition made on wages. I do. I have business cards. I brought everything. I'll leave it over here. Is that, or do you, I don't know how you guys want to do it. But I'll just put it at the end of the table. Okay. I'm sorry. You had a question? Okay. All right. So I will just leave the information over there. And I have business cards.
This was really great information. We appreciate both of you coming to talk about that. Very, very excellent. Thank you.
And I thought it was, it just worked out nice that it was both together.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you all for
Thanks.
Your time. Yeah.
Absolutely. Lynn has a comment.
This is just to go back to when Katie was talking about puns and going through the eligibility. She mentioned Mary Rasher's work each year updating the enrollment information. And in the board packet, you have some documents that, sort of adjacent to that and funded by the DDB. Mary Rasher also asks people at that annual meeting what they want. And that results in this preferences assessment, which you've received for about, I think, 5 years. And we actually we use that in the priorities document and in planning for the next round of funding priorities. And this is one of the things that that unit was recognized for with a national award in the spring because of this work. Because it's beyond what they do for the state. They're doing this and a few other important functions for this board.
Okay, board direction. Ideas, comments, brainstorming. Okay. Item G, success is another agency information.
Yes. Sarah Perry from DSC. We are serving a gentleman that moved to us from Chicago. And he spent his time taking care of his elderly parents. He did not receive services until he came into the Champaign area. His parents had passed. He was living with his sister. So we currently serve him in case management and community employment and our apartment services program now. He definitely wanted to move out on his own against his sister's wishes. So we worked closely with him in budgeting and saving enough money for him to be able to live out his dream. And in September, he did move out, and he is currently living on his own. He's extremely proud of himself for doing that. And his sister is now at ease with him doing so, with supports. And he has found a huge passion for writing. He joined the MTD and writing group with Community First. And so he is currently waking up in the middle of the night and having his expressive self writing poetry. And he was recently published in, I think it was an advocacy newsletter with his poetry on Red. I highly recommend reading it. It's very passionate and sweet. So we are really enthused and excited for him, and he is going to be our Tree of Hope Personal Achievement Award recipient.
Laura, is he going to be presenting as one of the poets at the Crow? Oh, okay, good.
Thing. The Speak Out, Speak Up Summit is next Tuesday and Wednesday in Springfield. And the Advocacy Initiatives Board, which was previously the Community Conversations Board, changed its name, is going to be presenting. They're a group of self-advocates, and they're going to be presenting on our healthcare workers guide to supporting people with intellectual disabilities. So they created that guide, which I've talked about here before, but they put together a really nice presentation that sort of helping other self-advocates maybe use that and start to sort of play a bigger role in their interactions with both the support people that maybe are with them during visits to doctors or other healthcare professionals, as well as sort of being a bigger advocate to those professionals. So we're excited about that.
Sorry, yeah, one quick thing. This month, our transition consultants worked with the organization Family Matters and the Ligas Family Advocate through the state to host a workshop that was held at the Champaign Public Library for families on transitioning from secondary education to adult DD services. And the turnout was really great. There were over 50 people in attendance. It was a mix of families, and then we also had representatives from different community agencies and also professionals who work in the school. So that was really a well-attended event, and I think that's something that we would like to try and host on an annual basis here in Champaign.
Okay, so then skipping down to old business item B in our packets, on pages 61 through 65, we have utilization summaries for PY 2019. Those are results presented for information only. This is Kim's handiwork, is it not? Or is this a collaborative effort? Well, thank you for that.
So all year long, Kim is tracking data that's reported by all of the agencies who receive funding. And sometimes that involves asking for corrections or clarifications. This is a very basic overview of those data. She has way more detail than that. And I think the performance outcome report is done, the aggregate, but that's hundreds of pages. Yeah. So we wouldn't put that in the board packet, but we can give you a link to that.
Okay.
So this is not as informative as that. It's kind of like your annual service report.
Okay, as always, the meeting schedules are near the back of the book, pages 66 through 69. Actually, not near the back of the book this particular time because we have long staff reports that were very interesting. And our acronyms pages are 70 through 77. Any CCMHB news input?
They're meeting this evening, and their agenda is similar to yours. They don't have a mini-grant process, though. So hopefully they're getting jealous about that.
Okay, the staff reports begin on pages 78 through 135. I was wowed by Chandra's report this month. Thank you very much, especially all of your information about community healing and resistance through storytelling, the Sea Hearts. Great. Great. Thank you. Anybody else have any comments, questions about staff reports?
I just have a question in general. The letter about UCP can no longer serve Champaign County, how many individuals does that impact, and are those individuals being picked up by other agencies?
So I think it's about 24 people right now. I'm working with Katie, the ISC. Several of those individuals are already working with her staff for the conflict-free case management person-centered planning. For the people that aren't working with her staff, we're linking them up if they're PUNS eligible and PUNS enrolled. There's a few people that we still need to make the determination on. So,
can I add a quick thing? I'm sorry. So we also worked with UCP, and they had notified all their clients, and so we also had drafted and sent out a letter to all those clients letting them know that we can work with them to identify other services in the community and that they can reach out to us for support.
That's great.
I have a couple comments about the staff reports. The International Galleries show is Stephanie's baby. She got the gig, and she's been managing it. And this, so when you all put the DSC art in there, or when you put it in, we had a retirement on the mental health board, and Kim suggested we give that person some of the original art. So I went over and I picked a piece of art that board member's family member was connected to, an artist who was a friend of her brother. And it happened to be the piece of art that Stephanie wanted to buy. So, but she's kind enough to wait and put it in the show. So it's a great show. And I think, since we're getting close to the holidays, you ought to go check it out. The prices are really good, too. And whatever you get is probably the next thing that Stephanie has her eye on. So, I'm sorry. And the other comment is Chris doesn't always have a staff report, but at the end of each quarter, he's giving you an update on, it's like a profit and loss statement. And I'm actually prepared for a couple of questions, but he's here. So it's the very, very last page of the whole board packet. Do you remember what my questions were? There were only two.
You were talking about the transfer from MHB to DDB. Has been repaid. It's just not reflected in that yet because that comes from statements that we get from the auditor's office. So they have not processed that or posted it on their end. It will be zeroed out.
Okay.
It will be repaid.
The other one was, there was some miscellaneous revenue, too, and that it was excess revenue returned. Okay.
Board announcements? Anything?
Next time we're in the Dimmitt room.
Okay, that's an announcement. Come to the right room next time. It'll be back in Dimmitt. Okay, it's 8 o'clock, right? We're all 8 o'clock. Yeah, it is. It's nice if we can get the microphones to work. Okay. And on that note, we are adjourned. Oh, no, Dr. Robin.
I said I had to leave, but I have one question. Is there a study session, and what is it?
You're right. It is not what we've done in the last 2 years where we had a joint study session for both boards, and I brought in a presenter that I thought would be great, and each time it was not. So great. This year instead, it's just a mental health board study session, but one of the things they'll be talking about in this next week is their commitment to funding some DD programs. So I think it's just under $700,000 that they're committed to spend next year. on DD programs. And so that, you know, that's a lot of money. But anyway, so they'll be looking at the draft of priorities that I've presented to this board. So if you want to come, you are always welcome at their meetings and study sessions. I think they largely rely on this board to define those priorities. But so it is absolutely open to both boards. It's just we also put the DD discussion first, so if you do come, you don't have to stay for the rest, because they're going to talk about system of care as well.
Thank you. Now we are adjourned, right? Thank you all.